Please be seated. Well, my first word must be, I'm glad to be back. It's so good to see you all. We had a wonderful time in Italy. We just found a way to lock part of our brain off, part of our memory off, the part that says that it was 106 degrees most of the days we were there. But aside from that, the Italians were good for what they do, and that is food and coffee, and honoring ancient places, which they do so well. So, but let's look at our gospel lesson this morning. It's so rich and full and a little bit scary that it's worthwhile spending some time on it. First of all, the context. What's the context of what this story? The context goes back, if we were to look at it, two Sundays. Jesus has brought the message, the news, that John the Baptist had been beheaded in prison. And we don't know what his reaction was, but we can guess. We can guess both because Jesus is human like we are, and because of some of the things that are in the scripture itself. And one of the things that's in the scripture that makes a difference is when Jesus heard about it, he departed from his disciples and he went up in the mountain to pray. Now, that part we know from the text. The part that we can guess is this. That when Jesus heard this news, he was devastated. John the Baptist may have been his cousin. Whether he was or not, we don't know. But he was clearly a follower of John. Might be considered a disciple of John the Baptist. John the Baptist had quite a few disciples, at least three of whom came and joined Jesus after John died, became one of Jesus' disciples. So Jesus was close to John, either by family ties or by a shared sense of mission. Jesus even picked up some of the language and concerns and interests of John and made them his own in his own ministry. But we can be pretty sure that he was devastated, partly because he was on a similar path. A path that might take him to being beheaded in a king's dungeon. And that must have been scary indeed. So the text tells us that Jesus tells his disciples, the word here is he made them get into the boat. The actual Greek is a little harder than that. It says he compelled them. He forced them to get into the boat. Now, what does that mean? I don't know. Other than Jesus felt like he had to be separate from his disciples, from his followers, for another period of time, so he could go up again to the mountain and pray. Now, we've talked in many sermons, about how so many elements of the gospel message are metaphorical and symbolic, and that what the writer does, in this case Matthew, but also Luke and Mark and John, they will put elements in the middle of their story that are richer and fuller and greater than the possible words could ever be. And here is an example. What does Jesus do when he hears about John? He goes up to the mountain. After he feeds 5,000, what does he do? He goes up to the mountain to pray. Now, we know in the Gospels, particularly in Matthew, whenever it says he goes up to the mountain, that's symbolic language for what? Does anybody remember? What did Moses do up on the mountain? Got the Ten Commandments. Who did he get them from? God. So when Moses goes up to the mountain, what is he expected to do, or who is he expected to meet? God. So Matthew, who very much draws on all of the Old Testament, Matthew is a deeply Jewish book. And so when Matthew talks about Jesus responding to this terrible event, what does he have him do? Get to that mountain. Get to that mountain and pray. Get to that mountain and encounter God. Get to that mountain and be reminded of who you are and what you're about to do. Get reminded that you have been called. So, there's the mountain. Jesus goes up in the mountain. There's another symbol that's very important in this text. And it's one that goes all the way back to the first verse of the book of Genesis. It goes all the way back to the beginning. And that is the storm, the stormy sea, what was known in Greek as the watery chaos. And in the first few verses, particularly the first verse of Genesis, it tells us that God created the heavens and the earth out of nothing. Now, everybody at that time who knew that story knew what it was. When it says nothing, that was the rabbi's way of making fun of the great god Marduk, a Babylonian god, who has to wrestle and struggle and fight for all he's worth to defeat a terrible dragon, the dragon that will destroy all of civilization. This dragon wants to eat everything alive. It's so destructive. And it's the word for the dragon is from the deep. And so every time throughout the rest of the Old Testament, whenever we see the deep mentioned, wherever we see the watery chaos mentioned, wherever we see the storm mentioned and the sea, we know that we have here the enemy of God, the enemy of humanity, the enemy of creation itself. So every time we see it throughout the Psalm, how many times is in the Psalms, the book of Job, that there is an encounter between God and the sea? What happens? What's the greatest thing that could happen to Israel? It's to be free of Egypt and do what? Cross the Red Sea. Who's in charge of the sea? We always think of the sea as in charge of the sea. It's terrifying. It's murderous. It's the enemy of creation. And here now under God, the Israelites are walking over the sea. This idea of the stormy sea as a threat to all that is, to all that God has made, accompanies the Bible throughout to the very end. In the book of Revelation, now let's just be clear about one thing. The Bible was written over 1,000 years. It wasn't like a group of people got together and say, well, let's say this, and let's do this, and let's do this. It was over 1,000 years. And many of the books were written without any knowledge of any of the other books. Now, many of them had the knowledge of other books. But in this case, it's John. And what does he say when he's describing what is going to be? He says, and the sea was no more. Now, to a Jew who's living under Roman exile, as the writer John is doing, as the Jew who's living under the terror of the Roman sword, as a Jew who's living under constant oppression, the constant destruction, potential destruction of life by the sea, by the watery chaos, by the forces of corruption, to hear that the sea is no more is like coming to you when you are deeply ill and you hear the words, you are healed. The fact that in this symbol of the sea is the gospel is what's one of the things extraordinary about this passage. But let's go on. Peter feels compelled to step out of the boat. And you know the story. He steps out of the boat. He looks at Jesus. He takes his eyes off Jesus. And we've heard 1,000 sermons on this, right? He took his eyes off Jesus and he sank. And so don't, never take your eyes off Jesus. Well, that can get very tedious after a while in our life. But there's something else going on here that's important. This passage, I think, this is not from Sinai now. This is Gordon. This passage, I think, is misplaced. You know how the gospel writers wrote, right? Each gospel writer, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they took stories from the preaching of the disciples, and they listened to those stories, and they wrote them down, and they put them in various arrangements. So kind of imagine a very modernistic necklace that has different shapes and different colors. And each shape and each color represents a different gospel story. That gospel, then, is the necklace. The completed gospel is the necklace, and the things that make up the necklace are the different stories. And each gospel writer puts the stories in different places. So they're not all in the same place. And Matthew has this story about Jesus walking on the water and the disciples being terrified and fearful and ready to drown, and they don't know who this figure is standing before them.
When we look at the gospel lessons and Jesus' appearance in amongst his disciples, it was always physical. It's always a physical connection between Jesus and the disciples. Only after the resurrection does that change. And suddenly, Jesus just appears, right? The disciples are meeting in an upper room, and Jesus is dead, and they're upset and crying and wondering, what are we going to do now? And suddenly, the doors are locked, right? We all know this story. The doors are locked, and boom, suddenly Jesus is standing there. And for the next 40 days, 40 nights, whatever, Jesus appears without any warning. Just appears, and there he is. And what is Jesus doing? But he's bringing a kind of teaching that he could not have brought in the flesh when he's just with his disciples. And so now he is appearing episodically. A very different kind of relationship of Jesus with the disciples. A relationship that's more like ours. Because Jesus isn't here, right? I mean, I look out in the pews and you're all such wonderful Christians, but none of you is Jesus. Jesus no longer appears amongst us the way he appeared amongst the disciples. Now he's appearing in strange ways, spiritual ways, powerful ways, ways that we don't quite understand. But we do know this, that when he does, he calls us into a new and deeper form of discipleship. He calls us into the watery chaos. The watery chaos, which is the threat to all that exists, Jesus is standing in the midst of it. Symbolically, it was he stands in that water. And Peter gets out and stands with him for a while. What's the important part of this story? The important part of this story is that Jesus continues to appear to us to give us strength, but also to send us out into the watery chaos to make a difference. Let me tell you a story. A number of years ago, set in 1974, I worked for the World Council of Churches in Geneva, Switzerland. We were working on a huge worldwide project on science and faith. And one day my chief, the head of my unit, calls me in and says, Gordon, we want you to go up to Bonn for a special meeting of the Nobel Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation. We want you to represent us. Whoa. Okay. So I got on the train and went up there and to Bonn and got my packet of information. If you've ever been to a conference, you know, at the opening, there's a packet of information. You take that. And I'm looking through it. I don't even know what the topic is. I look through it and see that there's a keynote address. And the keynote address is given by one Gordon Schultz. I have no idea that was he was there for. So I sat up all night writing up this keynote address. But that wasn't the important part. The important part was who was there. This was an organization or a conference made up of some of the most important, well-known, greatest scientists alive at the time. They were the best. And they came to us, they came to the church, to ask if we would help them think through something so terrifying that people didn't even know what to do. And they called this, when I think about it years later, I'm still amazed. The scientists are hard-nosed, empirical. They don't want none of this religious claptrap. Science, you know, we don't go for the hocus pocus. We want to see facts. We want to see numbers. We want to see models. We want to see the mathematics. And these scientists called the church. Said, help us think through this problem. We can't do this on our own. These are the greatest scientists in the world at that time. In what area? In the area of something I had never heard of. Climatology. Climate? Oh, I know what climate is. Climatology? Study of climate. Didn't know there was such a thing.
And for the next week, I heard one presentation after another that just left everybody shaking. About what? This is 1974. And everybody was shaking about what was coming. They had maps of the world that show which major cities of the world would be inundated because of the change in climate and the rise of the temperature, surface temperatures of the earth, and the rise of sea level. They used the phrase, and I don't know if they knew what they were doing, but one person used the phrase, this watery chaos. It was right out of the Bible. He talked about fearing this watery chaos which would destroy civilization. And the thing that still gets me is that they called upon Christians to help them think through this most empirical of problems. Now, we obviously didn't change anything, or maybe we changed a little bit, but not very much. I want to tell you another story about how, when called upon, Christians make a difference. It was 1979. We had just moved up to Boston from Princeton, and I was shocked. I had this image of Boston as being kind of very sophisticated, and just everything is great, and there's a sense of history, and there is an awareness of the long tradition of the Patriots up into the present, and there's a lot of pride in New England. And that's not what I saw. The first thing, my first day there, I wanted to get the newspaper. I hadn't yet signed up for it yet. Went down to the corner store, figuring I'd pick up the Times and the Globe. There was no Times, there was no Globe. Instead, there were about six or seven newspapers, all from different counties in Ireland. This was Dorchester. Dorchester is Irish City. And one of the most painful parts of that Irish City is that we had not been there more than a week or two when two young men, teens, were walking down Dorchester Ave and they were attacked. They were chased and attacked viciously by a group of kids. Did I tell you that one of the young men was black? One was white and one was black. And this was so enraging to these white kids in Dorchester. Enraging that a white would be with a black in public like this. That they attacked him. One went that way, one went that way. The one that went that way went on to the Red Line tracks and was killed. The following week, a young black couple came out of a restaurant in Southie. And was it the same? I don't know. But some young punks were furious to see blacks in their neighborhood, in their restaurant. And they attacked them with sticks and 2x4s. And a young man ran into the midst of them to try to stop it. And they turned on him, and he ran out onto Fitzgerald Expressway, which you maybe may know as Route 3, and he was killed. A year later was a political campaign for the mayoralty of Boston, and that's often just a kind of family struggle between different clans. Different Irish clans, but this year it was a little different because a man by the name of Mel King was running for office. And Mel King, if you may remember, you may not because you're not from Boston, but Mel King was an African American. It's inconceivable. African Americans don't run. They don't dare go to restaurants. They don't dare be seen walking together down the street. Run for mayor of the city of Boston? He did. And his dignity and personal power transformed that election such that his opponent, Ray Flynn, from South Boston, who was known to be the most, no,
He was known to be one of the hard-line right-wingers and one of the ones who did everything he could to keep the schools from being desegregated. He fought furiously to keep the schools from being desegregated. That Ray Flynn was changed. And here's how I know. Because I was there. Ray Flynn won the election, obviously. And he went around from playground to playground in Southie and in Dorchester. And this is what he said. It's over. It's over. We're not doing these things anymore. It's over. What do you think happened? Nothing. In other words, it was over. Ray Flynn walked out of the boat, stepped into the watery chaos, and risked even his life. There's no question about it. People were crazy then. Risked his life and said, no more. We are now in a difficult situation that calls for us all, but especially our national leaders, to step into the watery chaos and to not be afraid, or to be afraid, but to step into the watery chaos anyway. You certainly know what has happened in Charlottesville the last 2 days. We've seen this before. This is not new. Charlottesville has seen it before, not so long ago. Have you seen the movie Detroit? Has anybody seen the movie Detroit? Please go see it. Please go see it. If you love your country, care about your country, please go see it. We need, at this moment, leadership that is unafraid to stand in the watery chaos. I was so distressed when our president did not speak to the issue. We saw another film this week, Dunkirk. Anybody seen it? See it. It's worth seeing. In these two stories, these two films, there were those who created the watery chaos. There were those who would do everything they could to destroy human life. They would do everything they could to arrogate power to themselves, unless somebody stopped them. 3,500 young men lost their lives at Dunkirk. About 120 people lost their lives in Detroit. 3 people lost their lives in North Carolina. It's time for our president to say, neo-Nazis do not belong in our civilization. The Ku Klux Klan does not belong, does not, cannot, should not receive the cover of civilization. It's not just another point of view. That's like saying a spring shower is like Hurricane Katrina. It's time for our leaders to unequivocally stand together and say without any hesitation that the KKK and the Nazis and the alt-right are not part of America. When Jesus got, when Peter got back into the boat, the wind ceased and died down. If we step into the watery chaos, we have no assurance that things will settle down. But that is where we belong. May it be so, even among us. Amen.